Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 18th. And Susan and Michael Thomas continue their series, Gates to the Holy City, People and Land. This is session four. It's entitled Golden Gate, Closure and Resurrection. Who will roll away the stone? And now let's tune in on Susan and Michael as they present.
With the Arabic peace song that we began to learn, Ya Abba Salami Amter Alena Salam, which means God of peace, rain peace upon us. Ya Abba Salami Im La Kulubina Salam, meaning fill our hearts with peace. The second time we sing it, we like to use this ending instead of Im La Kulubina. Use Im Na Biladina Salam, which means give our land peace. I hope some of you remember it, that's been here before. It goes, Ya Rabba Salami, that came up also at the end of the session last time about our pedagogy or methodology in these sessions. And that is that we made the decision when we had the opportunity to come here to Holden that we would be presenting information about the Palestinian experience and about things that we have witnessed in that regard. Because we have assumed that you've heard more clearly about the Israeli experiences. And that has been, in fact, verified during the time we've been here, that people have not been aware of some of the things that we have spoken about. Not that innocent victims on one side are any less worthy or valuable than innocent victims on the other. We just have I was told this morning by somebody that yesterday or possibly the day before it was, that there was an ambush of a Palestinian ambush of an Israeli settler bus in the north of the West Bank on their way to a settlement. And that seven people were killed, among them a baby, and 17 injured. And this was the first successful attack, the article said, since June 20th, when the sort of re-incursion into those areas began, so that all of these areas are really full of Israeli military. But since that time, 40 Palestinians have been killed, and 22 of them have been unarmed civilians. So just to realize that attack doesn't come out of nothing. Just to keep that in mind. I want to also just say that for me, understanding something about the Holocaust was probably the first clear understanding that I had in my life of systemic injustice. I had a best friend in, fifth and sixth grade, and sometime around 1960, there was a television program on the Holocaust, and I remember her coming to me and telling me these stories, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. And then I read The Diary of Anne Frank, read other books around that, You know, I remember sitting at the piano in my Minnesota, rural Minnesota home, pounding out the theme to the movie Exodus. You know, this land is mine. God gave this land to me. And identifying very much with the victimization of the Jewish people that was present in the Holocaust. I fantasized that maybe, you know, among my German ancestors, some might have been Jewish, you know, and all of that kind of stuff that perhaps some of the rest of you went through again. And I really took to heart this never again message. And asked myself, you know, what would be my response if I ever saw this kind of evil again? And that understanding about systemic injustice against a people because of who they are and not of what they've done or, you know, just who they happen to be, transfers. I mean, it transfers into the civil rights movement, into the rights for women, into any number of things, but it transfers. And I think just to have the sense that you it is not right that a people is punished for something that they just are. So that was, I just wanted to set that in place before we began. And for then for us to realize that the transferring comes in. And some of these facts which come from a July 8th article, two articles in the New York Times on July 8th, present some of this very difficult reality. Since September 2000 to the present, 4,000 Israelis have been wounded and 550 Israelis killed. At the same period of time, 35,700 Palestinians have been wounded and 1,450 killed. That right now, 700,000 people in 7 of the 8 major towns of the West Bank, Palestinian towns, are under curfew, which means they can't leave their houses unless the curfew is lifted for a few hours every couple of days to do errands. And a million more that are in the surrounding villages can't get into those major cities for their for school, for work, for medical services. This is a tremendous scandal in this whole thing that medical assistance has been really kept from people.
So this is just a nighttime curfew, huh? This is
No. All 24 hours. 24 hours a day.
So Bethlehem has been under curfew now for more than 3 weeks since the latest reoccupation, and it's lifted every couple of days. What you have to imagine is people staying in their apartment. They have a grandfather and grandmother living with them, and the grandfather has a heart attack. It's impossible to get him to a hospital. You call for ambulance service. They immediately begin to confer with the Israeli military about providing an ambulance, having the hospital send an ambulance. That takes several days for permission to be granted, if it is granted. But first, the grandfather dies. In Palestinian and Israeli society, you bury the person immediately, that same day. So you then contact the mosque or the church, explain that your grandfather has died and that you want to have a funeral. They begin to work with the Israeli military authorities in trying to secure a time the funeral can take place, and the procession and the mourning. That takes several days as well. So meanwhile, the grandfather is lying perhaps on a dining table, and there's no, you know, you don't have ice in the house. There's nothing you can do about that. And you get permission maybe 2 or 3 days later, and so a funeral cortege comes with people, usually not a car or a vehicle, and the men of the congregation carry the body on a flat board. If the man is Muslim, wrapped in a linen shroud. If the man is Christian, often there is a wooden coffin. And the coffin top is carried. The coffin top has a cross always on it. And so it's almost the processional cross for the gathering. And as people wind through the village, first to the church, people gather at the home, then they carry the body to the church. There's the funeral service, and then it goes immediately to the cemetery. And that's all done, all has to be done under permission of the Israeli authorities now. And so it's a very difficult thing. And most importantly, you can't go through the mourning process where the family of the women of the congregation, the women of the family, prepare a tea for people to come to the home and pay their condolences. So it's very difficult. So on one hand, somebody mentioned yesterday that they felt sort of yanked around. We were talking about Hebron, and then I pointed out the picture of a baby girl that had been, an Israeli settler girl, that had been killed in her father's arms walking through the marketplace. And that happens. We are yanked around. All of us are yanked around reading the story and the paper today. And what's interesting, and as a way of commentary on the papers, the New York Times article on July 8th, the top part of what Susan wrote, the number of people wounded and killed on both sides, that was an article about the hard road of rehabilitation for Israelis wounded by suicide or other terrorist attacks. And so it had several large pictures in color of Israelis. One picture, beautiful Israeli young woman taken before the attack. And then the picture of her as she's trying laboriously to paint a giraffe, and her face is disfigured, she's marred. And you know, your heart goes out to her. The art, that was the truth. That was a true picture. It wasn't a doctored image. The article told her truth. It told the truth about the number of people estimated to have been killed and wounded on both sides. But there was an editorial decision to format the article in that way. Occasionally, I think it's probably the other way, where you might have the Palestinian family mourning the death of their 5-year-old girl who was standing on her balcony and was shot by an Israeli bullet from a mile away. So you have to always be aware of the editorial decisions that are made in presenting the news.
And I think being yanked around, it's really important that we still are. It would be terrible if you couldn't feel for someone in their pain and suffering.
I think it's amazing and act of the Holy Spirit that there are people both within the Palestinian and Israeli camps that are actually working for peace. I'm sure each one of them has experienced such intense personal suffering. And I guess I'm particularly thinking of Palestinian people you've been describing, the pastors and the congregation members. If any one of those things were to happen to me in my home, I would be so outraged that I would want heads to roll politically at first. And I can't say how long it would take before I would want to take up a gun and start shooting someone. So the fact that there are people who have seen their children die and still say, we have to work for peace is just astounding.
In fact, there's a group of victims of terror on both sides, Israelis and Palestinians, mostly parents, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, and they have been meeting for, I think, since 1996. And they meet, I don't know what the status right now is, because it's especially difficult for many reasons to have these kinds of meetings. But they meet and they talk about their shared pain, and they realize their pain is no greater, nor is it any less than the pain of the others.
One of the things that we have for you to take when you go is a copy of an article that's in the July Lutheran, again provided by Fred Stricker, Winning the Enemy. It's by Mitri Rahab, the pastor of the Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, about his experience on April 4th of the Israeli soldiers coming to his home and to the church that he was that he is pastor of, and the International Center. But the thing I want to just mention about it at this point is that he really holds up this idea that we together we cannot be about making neighbors into enemies, but must make our enemies into neighbors. That's what continues to be the message. And so
that was really demonstrated at a worship service at the Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem following an earlier occupation. These occupations, suicide bombings, they begin to blur, and you can't always remember which occupation or which suicide bombing you're speaking of. So at the conclusion of one suicide bombing, which went essentially from Easter for 4 weeks, and so there had been no worship at the Christmas Lutheran Church for the most part because of the curfew. There was a gathering. Was it the first worship?
It was the first one since Easter.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Since Easter at that church. The Jolly Church hadn't been able to do Easter itself.
That's right. And so they gathered, and it felt like a kind of Easter service because just 2 days prior, the siege of the Church of Nativity had ended. On Friday morning, it ended. The church was closed until Saturday. We came with a group of congregation members as we had an abbreviated service at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in the Old City of Jerusalem. And then we immediately drove out in a variety of vehicles, our car, the Norwegian government's armor-plated Mercedes, Jeep, a variety of cars drove out to Bethlehem, where we worshiped then at 10:30. Our service begins at 9, their service begins at 10:30, and we worshiped, and it really felt like Easter.
Started with Jesus Christ is risen today. This is the bulletin from that day. You might want to read this.
And it was really wonderful to be welcomed. The church was packed, and that the people in Bethlehem saw that other people cared about them and wanted to worship with them was really a moving experience on both sides. And then what was really moving was that Mitri, at the end of the service, during announcements, thank people for coming, our congregational group that came, and then he thanked, there were 5 Israeli Jews that were there. And that's where he talked about the importance of making neighbors of those who have been determined to be enemies. Yeah.
We speak of the Israeli Jews. We had heard in our community and probably media that there were some Israeli soldiers that had laid down arms.
Yes, there are several hundred who have refused to serve in the territory.
This is the reserve soldier movement. You serve in the reserves until you are 45, is it? In the Israeli army, and so you generally are called up for, you know, 2 weeks of service or a month, a year.
Do you know what the response to that was, or?
There was a call to refuse to serve in the territories, and it began with a group of about 40, and it's since expanded. I think before we left in
some of them have been prosecuted. Been reassigned to areas that aren't within the West Bank. There are some articles that we've cut out that are in the boxes out here that include some articles about that. That exactly. So
part of what makes that really dramatic, my understanding, is that the whole social system is dependent upon your time in the army.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So their insurance,
exactly.
Their pension, everything, by making that stand.
Exactly.
they have nothing. So it's, you know, it's not just, I'm not sure.
I mean, you're advancing Israeli civil society.
Yep, right.
And then that also then plays for the Arab Israelis in that they are not,
not in the army.
Required to serve in the army. And therefore they don't have the same sort of network of potential advancement that Israeli Jews do. Though one thing that must be said is that if you are a so-called refusing to serve in the territories, your sentence might very well be just several weeks or several months, and then you're called again. But it's not, as it is in the United States, a five-year sentence for draft resistance, for instance.
So today we're going to be talking now about the closures, the containment that is so much a part of Palestinian life, blocking of the way forward, and the need for resurrection.
We have fewer slides today. Let me just ask, has anyone not been to a previous session?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll show the...
You don't have to back up for me.
We don't have to back up.
First couple of slides. We'll pass over them pretty quickly.
Well, for those of you who are new, this tells you who we are, and take a cross when you leave. Okay?
The theme is, as we've mentioned all week, is peace in the Middle East. We situate ourselves in the old city of Jerusalem, and we use a map that goes back about 14 centuries, 13 centuries, a mosaic map. This is a facsimile, and it's about a third larger.
And we see these various gates to the city at that time that are being represented. There most likely were more, or potentially were more at the time, but we might be talking about this one for all I know. I'm not sure.
Now, the city walls now are different than and have expanded considerably from what they were, say, in the first centuries following the Jesus movement. This is a picture from our house roof of
the wall.
Old city of Jerusalem, and what the Jews refer to as the Temple Mount, or the Muslims the Noble Sanctuary, and that's the Dome of the Rock.
Again, you can't see the gate that we want to be talking about, which is called the Golden Gate.
It's a double gate.
It's either behind this tree or behind this one.
No, it's there.
Somewhere in that wall.
And it's a bricked up gate, and medieval legend had it that was the gate that Jesus came in to Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. But since the gate hadn't been built then, it seems an unlikely tradition. And it is also the gate that the Messiah is thought to will come through.
This is a Muslim graveyard here.
And so just opposite, we're taking the picture across the Kidron Valley. We're on the Mount of Olives. And to the south of us, also on the Mount of Olives, there's a very large Jewish cemetery. And the image that you want to carry with you is of the Messiah sweeping across the valley. And that's one reason why it's important, because of the holiness of Jerusalem, why these cemeteries are located where they are. And so the Jews are a little bit further away than the Muslims, because the Muslims have that cemetery.
So the Messiah will come in and through these gates.
Do they practice cremation at all?
No. And this is a picture of the Golden Gate. Each one has a name.
One is Mercy and one is Repentance. I don't know which one is which, but they have these names.
Which,
but you notice
now,
they aren't open.
Are they now bricked up, you said?
Yeah, they're now bricked up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And have been for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm. And the gate that's above is Lion's Gate, or St. Stephen's Gate. And Golden Gate is to the left of it. We're going to be talking about blockage today, barriers. We begin in Jerusalem, or excuse me, in Bethlehem on December 31st, and this is a march that was called for by the church leaders of Jerusalem, the leaders of the churches, the patriarch, the bishops, including the bishop that whose church we serve in, Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, or the Palestinian Lutheran Church. And this is a movement of both Palestinians and internationals, Palestinian Christians for the most part, and also some Palestinian Muslims. And you see the sign clearly saying, next year in Jerusalem, it's December 31st, 2001, and we're marching toward Jerusalem.
Do you know that phrase, next year in Jerusalem?
Yes. It's
from the Seder. From the Seder. Yeah. Every year at the end of the Seder meal, Passover time, the Jews will say, next year in Jerusalem.
And so we're hoping to be going through. We have a very large delegation. It's about 150 of Italians, which, first of all, give a certain life to the gathering. they're also working. They're marshals for this procession. Well, maybe we got that picture out of place. Okay. This is in Bethlehem. We're going to come back to this, but this is our church council. Susan's taking the picture, and we're meeting in Bethlehem, again, lifting up the image of blockage, because Elaine Zugbe, who is an American, married to a Palestinian, Zugbe, in Bethlehem, cannot leave Bethlehem, and so the church council comes to her. Also, the man on the left was a volunteer serving in Bethlehem and lived in Bethlehem. He could leave more easily than Elaine could.
We realized, of course, that there were people in our congregation living in Bethlehem who could not get into Jerusalem more often. And so this past year, in September, we began a bi-monthly, or twice a month, semi-monthly service in Bethlehem for English-speaking people so that we could gather.
Mm-hmm. We're meeting at Christmas Lutheran Church. They generously offered their church. And by the way, this is a good time to mention that our congregation went through a discernment process early on during the Intifada, thinking about how should we respond and what kind of long-range planning could we do, meaning what kind of planning could we do for 6 months. And out of the discernment process, we met in Ramallah, Jerusalem, and Bethlehem. We realized that we needed to have a service in Bethlehem for English speakers. So we've done that bi-monthly since about the end of 2000, the beginning of 2001. And so Christmas Lutheran Church is where English speakers also worship.
Some of you might be interested to know that this is our Methodist, Anglican, Mennonite, Church of the Brethren, Lutheran Church Council.
And this is actually in the process of meeting right
this
here.
Is just to, this is the, in an area of the arts, where the arts and crafts are being trying to be developed in the Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, and so you see this nice stained glass work.
No. That's the stairwell.
Oh,
no.
that's the railing. Oh, I'm sorry. There are stained glass. I'm sorry. You're right. I'm too close to this. It matters what your perspective is.
Yeah.
What is it? What you see when you get up in the morning. And we're coming back to the image of the Golden Gate and a congregation picture, and Susan's going to point out what you should be noticing.
There's an arch that we look at each Sunday behind the altar, and it too is a door that has been blocked up. So just to carry the image in of these closed places, closed ways.
And so what we also want to mention is this is the Chapel of St. John that we worship in at Redeemer. There's a large sanctuary. There's a small chapel. This is a sort of a reconstructed refectory from the 12th and 13th century that had seen many uses. So it was a place where people gathered for meals. In 1948, we have pictures. This was this house, refugees from the war in 1948, this space. And so they had lots and lots of beds. They had an altar back in the back and then had these beds. So at one time, obviously, there was a door where Susan pointed, and that becomes a kind of image that we lift up. So we often move the altar to the right so that the door, the blocked door, is more prominent.
The story of the resurrection and the women moving toward the tomb and asking one another who will roll away the stone is a very poignant question for Palestinians at this point, and Israelis as well. Mm-hmm. Who will roll away this terrible stone that blocks our path?
Mm-hmm. We're back to the march, and the idea is that with a kind of true force, with a kind of spiritual force, we want to be able to walk through the checkpoint. We are led by the church leaders of Jerusalem. Also, there's a couple of Palestinian Authority figures there, but we have the Anglican bishop, we have the Latin or Roman Catholic bishop, we have a representative of the Greek Orthodox, we have Bishop Menib, who is the one with the cross right there. We have Syrian Orthodox. All the churches participated. We have the umbrella over there. The person wearing the umbrella is, so to speak, is the Armenian patriarch. And we are hoping to be able to walk through.
Do you have any Jewish rabbis?
I don't remember if there were any in that. They were supposed to be.
Oh yeah, they were coming from the other side
of the checkpoint
to meet us, to in a sense to accompany us. There you have a couple of the Italian marshals in the foreground.
Several of the pictures you have men with green hats. What are the green hats?
The green hats were simply for that day, and I think they say open Jerusalem
or stop the occupation.
So
there you have a picture in the center of Mitri Rahab, in the lower left corner Bishop Menib. And we don't know what's going to happen.
And right now,
we're already blocked, and we're still a mile from the checkpoint. We're blocked by the Israelis. They came up from Rachel's tomb, where there's a military fortress, Israeli military fortress, and they blocked the procession at this point. And I think that's why you see the looks of consternation or anxiety on the people's faces. Also, internationals walk together as well. Gustav Oquist, the man with the clerical collar, has served at ELCJ for the past 3 years, and he and his wife Ingrid have just this month returned to Sweden, where he will take up a new position in advocacy for the Palestinian Christians with the Church of Sweden. Sandra Olwein, who's a member of our congregation, is also now an assistant pastor at the Christmas Lutheran Church.
I don't know who this woman is, but she was obviously a clergywoman and probably coming as an international to participate in this event.
And we get up to the checkpoint. We're just about 100 yards from the checkpoint, and that's as far as we can go. And one of the things that's interesting is that the soldiers are pretty relaxed there. They have body armor on, but they're relaxed. They're sitting on top of a jeep. You would not see that kind of relaxation now. They would be likely pointing guns, ready to shoot, because they know that they are not willing to be shot first. And so we've gotten about as far as we're going to go. We have a prayer service, which is basically Christian prayers, but there were also some Muslim prayers. And one of the things that some of us had hoped was that we hoped that the church leaders would push through and force the Israelis to arrest them. And that didn't happen. And we speculated as to when are they going to do that. And and take those kinds of actions that are so necessary. It's, some people speculate that it's because the church leaders have what are called VIP cards, and that they didn't want to lose those VIP rights that the card entails, the ability to cross over, though now it's not worth a lot. But they were cards of privilege, and I was talking with Wanda from Brazil yesterday, and we were talking about this, and she mentioned how, of course, we have, for instance, myself as a white North American, my VIP card is permanently stamped on me. It would be difficult to give it up. It's just there. It's an assumption that I carry, that I'm going to be able to cross. And for a Palestinian that has not been able to cross, that has been perhaps as a child told by the Israelis to go back home, mistreated, or have seen relatives mistreated, these VIP cards are very important. And Wanda pointed out that you can't, you know, they have to decide that they will no longer rely on these VIP cards. Other people can't tell them to do that, and that is very true. So we're going now, we're jumping from December 31st, 2001 to the end of March, Easter Sunday to be precise. For a week there had been a great deal of tension in Bethlehem as the rest of the West Bank north of Jerusalem had been reoccupied. We were waiting for it to happen in Bethlehem. Everyone said, just wait till the Western Easter is over, then they will come in. And so on Easter weekend, troops began massing around Bethlehem.
Easter night now.
Yeah. We're at Tantur, which is a Catholic ecumenical research center. It's owned by the University of Notre Dame, and it was a dream, a vision of Pope Pius VI of a place where, first of all, Christians from around the world could come and talk, as well as Jews and Muslims. And this is land that is owned, as I mentioned, by the University of Notre Dame, and there are Israeli troops swarming around it. What they are doing is there's a large mass of troops below them, just outside the walls, and they're providing cover because they don't want someone to come in with weapons from higher ground and potentially shoot.
Just to, we probably need to go a little quicker.
Okay. You want to say something?
This Israeli woman is starving for peace. She was doing a fast at the border of this ecumenical center on the Bethlehem side, and trying to get people to
a place where Palestinians could also come and Jews, and occasionally that happened. But
she's
now
in this tent, and we're looking and
towards
looking
Bethlehem.
Out toward Bethlehem.
And now that's impossible. Because you can't get there. This is at Tantur as well. Through that
door.
So
her tent was just right outside. Yeah. Right.
Through this door, hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians came each day because it was.
We're on the Tantur side.
They would bypass the checkpoint and come through and search for work or sell vegetables in Jerusalem. Now, this was also, we found out, it was called by Palestinians the Golden Gate. So I want to come back to the image of the blocked Golden Gate. But sadly, this is now blocked as well. At times, the Israelis welded it shut in the past 2 years, but it was always reopened. But now it is permanently closed, and Palestinians can't get there. These soldiers are challenging these women, and they're ordered. The rifles were pointed at them just prior to this photograph. We were standing there. We had just been talking with those soldiers. They saw us, and I think that was one reason why they allowed the women to come through. They were coming back from having spent the day in Jerusalem working or selling vegetables. And they first had to drop the things that they were carrying and stand like this with the soldiers pointing at weapons at them.
They were pretty feisty, though. I have to say, you know, we could overhear them having a conversation.
And this is looking down from the contour as troops start to gather. As reservists show up for duty, it's a kind of farewell send-off. And so you have the Israelis from across all the sectors of Israeli society, secular and observant Jews, coming to say farewell. And there were hundreds of military vehicles gathered around Bethlehem, just in this one area. This is maybe the strangest sight. They have these sort of, it looks sort of like desert dune buggies, you know, and everyone is wearing those goggles, you know, as they swoop around.
So we were driving back into Jerusalem at that point, and they were coming.
Okay, and so Bethlehem has been reoccupied then, and food needs are serious, and we decided to organize, we meaning the various Christians, Lutheran World Federation took a lead role in it, but especially Catholic Relief Services and World Vision decided to organize a food convoy. And so we got various trucks together, and this was the first one. And so it was all sort of new, and how do we go about it? Everyone in every truck was numbered. And so we met on the Mount of Olives at Augusta Victoria, and we left and we drove no more than a mile down the Mount of Olives, and one of the trucks turned the wrong way, and the other truck broke down. And for those of us who live there, this wasn't such a big surprise. But then we regathered, we got more trucks because these trucks were far too
overloaded.
But we then drove out to Tantur, where we waited for the trucks to be reloaded and meet us out at Tantur. Tantur has a very important in-between role. And so we're on the roof of one of the buildings at Tantur, which really doubles as a kind of porch. And we're looking at Bethlehem. And right now there's firing going on. That's why people are peering over. Firing in Manger Square adjacent to the Church of the Nativity. And we're watching that. As it happens, the trucks are reloaded. We begin our convoy, and we come in through Beit Jala at what's called the district operating command. And
Bethlehem lies between another village called Beit Jala and Beit Zahor, where the Beit Zahor is where the shepherd's fields traditionally are thought to be. So you have these three villages that really run into one another as one.
So we're bringing food, and we stop first. We're going to go to Beit Jala, Bethlehem, and Beit Zahor, three different drop-off points. And we first stop at a Catholic seminary and school in Beit Jala. And we had timed the visit to do this when there was no curfew. We have, of course, received permission from the Israelis. This was all carefully choreographed with the Israelis so that there would be no problem. But unfortunately, because of the delay in reloading the trucks and finding other trucks, we came during curfew. So people are scrambling everywhere. And we're unloading the truck, but as we leave, we have people coming. This is a story that's really worth telling. This is a pastoral associate, Peter Loof, who's a Swedish Church of Sweden Lutheran pastor who worked in our congregation for 2 years. And the day before, you see that these are vegetables in our, we have a Volkswagen van. The day before, we had gone to our local vegetable store, and we had been given 100 shekels, you know, somewhat less than $20. By a member of the congregation to bring some groceries, in addition to all the other food that was being brought. And we were the first Muslim.
So we decided we were gonna bring fresh vegetables since that wouldn't have been part of the convoy food.
And the grocer was a Muslim. And our youngest son mentioned the purpose for her journey. And then he immediately began to just take bag after bag after bag of groceries, saying they have nothing to eat. Please take this. The children will like this. The adults will like this. And so we had half a Volkswagen van filled with almost all of his vegetables. And he, there was no kind of, sometimes there's a kind of implied, you know, when you deal with, you know, shopkeepers, you know, I'll give you this gift, you know, this wonderful gift, and it's, of course, to entreat you to spend more, to get, to come back. There was nothing at all. If we had never come back to that store, it would have been fine with him. It was really a wonderful gift to be able to pass these vegetables out to people. And this is the former German Probst, or head of the German church, and more significantly in terms of the context of the story, Maurice, who lives in Beit Jala. He's a Christian, as he told me, for about 600 years, as near as he could tell. He was educated as a chemical engineer in the Ukraine, and he works as the doorkeeper at the Church of the Redeemer. He speaks fluent Russian, and he's learning German. And we're trying to make contact with Pastor Jadala of the Beit Jala Lutheran Church, the Church of the Reformation. And because this German was the former German Probst, he had left, and he came back specifically to be with Palestinians in this difficult time. And so we're trying to arrange a meeting.
Maurice, I just want to say something else about him. He is, he of course expected that since we had gotten to Beit Jala, that we would be able to come to his house for tea, which we had to promise on our honor that we wouldn't leave the convoy when we started in there that particular day.
Because we never knew when the curfew would be.
But the hospitality that he was so ready to give is very important. He is also, as one of the Palestinian people who work at the Church of the Redeemer in Jerusalem, we know when the closure is complete, because he is always there from Beit Jala. He will make his way however and however long it takes him to get to his job at our church. So when Maurice doesn't arrive, we know there's no way in.
No one can get through.
And the other story about him is that when the siege of the Church of the Nativity was lifted and the whole Christian community and the Muslim community too, but we're going back into the church on May 12th to celebrate having it back and celebrate the resurrection, in a sense. We saw him there as well, and the irony of his being a doorkeeper, of being then closed in, and then seeing him there at that place where we were celebrating resurrection was wonderful.
And as I mentioned, we didn't time it so well. So the curfew had been lifted, and oh, there are cars everywhere as people are trying to get food, both the food that we brought and food elsewhere from stores. And what was really moving, I mentioned that you have the church leaders who maintain a kind of dignity. And so there were no church leaders with us this day, except because they would have had to have ridden in vans or trucks, except for the Syrian Orthodox. And the Syrian Orthodox are sort of my favorites, or sometimes my favorites in Jerusalem, and this man in particular who's the head. And so he rode in a van filled with groceries, and he was sort of in hiding because the Israelis wouldn't have allowed him in. It was supposed to be internationals, and except for the Palestinian drivers. And so then we went from Beit Jala to Bethlehem. We stopped at the Syrian Orthodox Charity, where we dropped off another shipment of food. And so he was there. And so his people were just really happy to see him, that he had come to them. And it was equally important for him to be there as well. And again, it was a happy day as people were able to get food, and know also that people from outside cared about them. And we left, again the same way. What's interesting, and you, maybe Susan, can you just point out that ambulance that's out there? Is that there's an ambulance that has just gone out, that's over on the left behind the concrete. And so what has happened is that an ambulance from Beit Jala or Bethlehem has come out, to this military headquarters, has gone around the corner after it had been searched in front of us, and they are taking the patient out, and the patient and that ambulance that you see there. And we saw that with our own eyes. And that's typical.
So they had to transfer the patient from one ambulance.
Transfer and search.
The patient is searched as well.
If they let you go at all.
So that's it.
Good.
I don't think there's nothing
more. Nothing more there?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's turn that off.
Maybe turn on the lights.
Now, I wanted to talk about some of the issues surrounding the siege of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, the site, the traditional site of Jesus' birth. It's a little bit, you know, there are many places where you can look for a sort of microcosm of life, but here you had Muslim and Christian, but mostly Muslim gunmen, theoretically, but people in this site, in a Christian site, surrounded by Jewish Israeli troops. Okay, so you've got these rings here, you know, of those who have taken sanctuary in the church and, in a sense, taken advantage of the age-old use of holy site and the churches as a place where people can go for sanctuary when they are being pursued. Happening. There were very few Christians among the civilians that were in that had taken refuge in the church. About 2%, which is just like in the society at large, among those who had come in there. But there were, of course, this other layer of Christians, which is also very much a part of the society, the monks and the nuns who
are these people? Mostly international, not entirely international, but they were Armenians and Catholics and Greek Catholics and Orthodox Greek. And so it was a wide range. Franciscans, they were a very important role in the siege. So context is everything. Susan mentioned from where she was sitting, it looked like there was stained glass, and she wanted to point out the importance of the arts at the Christmas Lutheran Church. So context is important. From the Israeli perspective, they were pursuing terrorists. From the Palestinian perspective, they were seeking refuge, sanctuary, protection when the Israeli military came into Manger Square. The Israelis had to know that this was the most sensitive part of Bethlehem, right in the very center, where you have this ancient church that tradition says is the birthplace of Jesus Christ, a grotto or cave below the church. And so you have people fleeing in. You have a variety of stories, and this really also encapsulates the Palestinian conflict. Now you have stories that are diametrically opposed. You have the Israeli interpretation, you have the Palestinian interpretation, then you have Christians who say this is the best thing that ever happened for Christian-Muslim relations in Bethlehem. You have Christians say this is terrible that we allowed those Muslims to come in to our church. Why did Patriarch Sabah allow this? You know, and well, he had to, or he was forced to. And but couldn't the Franciscan say, but you know, the Greek Orthodox, they won't like this. And the Greek Orthodox could say, well, you know, those Franciscans, and they could have found a way to keep them out. And one story that seems very plausible is that in the midst of the Israelis coming into this key area of Bethlehem, highly sensitive area of Bethlehem, everyone fled. So you could have been a terrorist, or you could have been an ordinary policeman, a young man, hardly a man, almost still a boy, fleeing because you didn't know what was happening and going into the church to seek sanctuary. You also had some civilians. You didn't know what the Israelis were going to do to you. That, I think, is a really important aspect.
One of the things that Israel has prided itself on is protection of holy sites and trying to be responsible about how these sites are treated and people having access to them. And this was a case where I'm sure you heard something about this while it was happening, but this picture, of course, you can't see anything on. But anyway, this thing that you see coming up here is a crane with a robotic arm on it that also had some capability of shooting into.
Well, it had a sniper rifle.
Sniper rifle.
And then there was also another crane.
It hung over the Church of the Nativity and could shoot into the compound there. And within the time that people were holed up there, seven people were killed on this holiest site of Christianity, or one of the two holiest sites of Christianity, were killed by Israelis in that holy place. And it is a real failing on the part of Israel to have allowed or proceeded with that kind of desecration of a holy site.
And let me just say what the Israeli explanation is. They said these people were shooting back, and if virtually no one within the church says that there was any shooting. Secondly, people say that if this is true, why don't the Israelis, since they used a video camera to spot people and to sight and to manipulate the rifle, and release the videos that show people shooting back at them. Instead, you have people that were going out to the bathroom. You have people that were trying to put out a fire that was started by the Israelis, some kind of grenade that was thrown over.
Two that were going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Some were trying to get grass to eat the grass. Mm-hmm.
So there
was a bell ringer that was killed outside of the church, a retarded man.
Yeah.
Yeah, we read about him. Yeah. And in fact, that was a really moving story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And people, I mean, prior to this siege, there was a 14-year-old that was killed coming out of the church one day. Anyway, let me just mention, it's a quarter of. Anyone who would like to leave should feel free to leave. We are glad to talk with people until noon if you would like to stay then.
Just a question about the terrorists. Supposedly they were seeking refuge. There were guns.
Mm-hmm. There were guns.
There were guns in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And was there, I got the feeling, I'm trying to remember if this was a scene that they were specific terrorists. Were there specific terrorists? That they
no, the Israelis did not know who
no,
was in
they
there.
Didn't know who was in
they did not know who was in there, and they could not have.
So they called the whole group terrorists.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
250 terrorists are in the.
But these people, how many ever did have some guns and they sought refuge?
There were, I think there were many guns. They were the ordinary. Palestinian policemen that ran in, they had a gun. There were terrorists.
The place
Abu
is a
Baya
fortress.
Clan.
It looks like a fortress. It is a, you know, it's been
it was
used
meant
as
to
a
protect.
Fortress.
It was meant to protect Christians.
This little door.
You know, throughout the centuries from attack. So you have a clan of gun runners from Bethlehem. They are in there. They are not. Good people,
right.
And they're probably the people that would go up to Beit Jala in cars, get out of the car, fire off a round of ammunition, and get back in the car, and they would be gone in 15 seconds.
Right.
It's that clan. They are in there. They're the ordinary Palestinian security people. They're in there. Wide mixture, and then there's some civilians that are there. There are the religious that are in there. It's a mix of people who are
After the negotiations for the siege to end had been going on for some time, Israel actually finally got the names of the people. Got the list of the names.
Right.
It turned out that, and this we heard later from people involved in the negotiations, that there were four names that they recognized as people that they wanted. But they knew, in terms of public relations, that they could not say, this is all about four people. And so, I think it was ended up the 13, wasn't it 13?
Yeah.
That were demanded, you know, that had to be expelled to Gaza. And
they published that in the Jerusalem Post, about 13 names.
Yeah, that there were 13. And so somehow the number 13 seemed to be more plausible for them. And so that was the list. And I mean, it's amazing to me, too.
There are a lot of people who have over centuries have sought refuge in the church. And in Mitri's book, I'm a Palestinian Christian, he talks about his early life, seeking refuge there himself with his mother. We talked to friends of ours who live basically a block from the south side of the Nativity Church wall. And while you talk about the curfews ending so people could go out, those people didn't because they were so close to the Church of the Nativity. Mm-hmm. And I talked to them on the phone, and it was like she said, you know, it's not just my husband and I in the house, it's extended family. And there were like 11 people, and they were rationing out rice to survive. There was an infant with them. And finally, the mother and the oldest daughter, who's a friend of our youngest daughter, about 20, they just dared to go out to try and get food one day, because they were so desperate for food. And their home had been searched twice in one day. They were forced to get out in the rain. And I talked to the girl who's 20, who's the oldest child, and she was just so frightened. And she said, I just was so scared, I fell to the ground. And they took everything out of their cupboards and forced them all out of the house into the street. The grandfather is very ill, needing to go for cancer treatments. He could not go. So that's how their life was during this time. And the mother of the 20-year-old, I spoke to her, and she's a good friend of mine, and she said, you know, I was trying to tell Michael and Michelle, her husband and her, to take Isa, the oldest son, and the boys, and go into the Church of the Nativity. The grandmother was livid that the son, the father of the family, and the grandsons did not go into the Church of the Nativity to seek refuge, because there are so many searches and seizures of the homes in Bethlehem that they feared that the military would come and take them, and they wouldn't know where they were taken to or they would be, because that traditionally is what happens all the time. So it was natural for the people of Bethlehem to send their males into the Church of the Nativity to seek refuge. So that part of the story is not heard.
I should tell just a little story that really corroborates the hunger in Bethlehem for the people that could never leave during the siege of the church, who live in adjoining areas. We talked about a Christian peacemaker team yesterday, and one of the things that they initiated that I participated in was called Operation Baby Jesus. And there is a story in this issue of the CPT Signs of the Times, if you'd like to read it. Anyway, the idea was that it would be helpful to get into the church to see what was happening, to be able to bring food. At that time, the reports were that there was very little food in the church. It turns out, actually, there was quite a bit of food in the church, that the food was not an issue. Mm. So I know the person went out to get grass, but there was a tremendous amount of food.
At least when they finally got in, there were caches of food. So I don't know what that's about.
Where it came from.
And where, you know, it depends, maybe one group of monks wasn't sharing with another.
Yeah.
Anyway, we decided that we would go, if we could have a kind of international witness there. This is before internationals came in. And we wanted to see what was happening. And we thought that it would be less likely if Israelis knew that there were internationals, that anything violent would happen. And it was the same kind of thought that Susan and I don't know how many of you remember Wounded Knee. Susan and I went to Wounded Knee with one other friend the day that it started, and with the same sense that if there were white people there, there would be less likely the possibility of violence. So it was that same thought. So I went with a group of CPTers. There was a Roman Catholic priest with me and an Anglican priest as well. And we walked down, we walked right into Bethlehem. There was no one out, no one out there in the streets. And it was scary. You see these armored personnel carriers buzzing by. And so finally we start to go up the street that Christmas Lutheran Church is on. There's a armored personnel carrier, its rear is open and there's soldiers in it. And the soldier comes running out. And we thought, okay, we're not gonna be able to go anywhere. Okay, he says, just a moment while we blow up this house, then you can keep going. That's what he said. And so we get behind this corner. Meanwhile, there are all sorts of soldiers that are down like this. I mean, those soldiers are afraid. They anticipate that they will be shot at. And so they're in battle-ready positions. And the house blows up, building blows up, okay. And they say, you better not go this way. Why don't you go around? Which actually, we were going to Bethlehem University, which is a Catholic University in Bethlehem. It's been closed. You know, its academic year is essentially and has unraveled. We rendezvous with a couple of other Christian peacemaker groups so that the purpose was not to attract attention by too large a group. Then we continue walking. We get into Mabasa Square, which is right next to the church, Christmas Lutheran Church. And it begins to look like a war zone there. It really, I showed you the pictures of Jenin, and that looks like an earth. That looked like, to me, I haven't experienced war. That looked like an earthquake. But when we walked by the church, it started to look like a war. Dead cats, water mains burst, glass everywhere, cars crushed. Normal cars about this time now because 60-ton tanks have gone over them. And then we walked down this narrow pedestrian alley, just finished 2 years ago for the millennium. Beautiful pedestrian area. You go by the craft gallery of Christmas Lutheran Church, and you walk down, and it is a war zone. As we're walking, we're carrying food with us, each a couple of bags of food. And people on the second floor cannot get out because of the there is no lifting of the curfew, calling, please, we have no food. Can we have some food? And we're walking down and we say, we will come back with some. We're trying to go to the Church of the Nativity. We walk down, we see no soldiers. It's very, very quiet. We walk into Nativity, into Manger Square. There's one tank, the turret of the tank about 45 yards away swivels and points directly at us. We keep walking. Then various loudspeakers say, don't move, in Hebrew, don't move. This is a closed military zone. Don't move, we will shoot you. I'm thinking, let's not move. And you can't see any soldiers. We thought we would see sandbags and lots of soldiers, but they're in the adjoining buildings. They're in the Peace Center. And you begin to pick out through camouflage over windows that there are soldiers behind them. And then eventually these soldiers come to us, and some CPTers are saying, let's keep going, let's not stop. But Sister Anne, the woman I mentioned yesterday, this 70-year-old Catholic nun, she says, we're not moving. And as she later explained, she said, as a nonviolent witness to peace, we cannot put on our conscience the possibility that we will cause by our movement of violence to be done, committed by an Israeli soldier, to have that rest on his conscience. We cannot do that. We must stop. And so we stopped and tried to negotiate, explain why we were going. And then we asked if we could pray there. They said no, because there are terrorists in that church there. They kidnapped holding hostage lots of people. It's very dangerous here. And so we start to walk back towards the mosque, which has suffered some damage, which is on the square. And then we drop by pre-assigned signal to our knees, and we decide to have our prayer. So we gave them the permission to tell us we couldn't pray at one spot, but then we took our own permission to pray. And then we walked back, and that was the time where, as the soldiers walked by with us, one soldier told me that he will try to get food to the church. Now, maybe he was just lying. And so we trusted him with some of the food. He said he would try. He couldn't promise, but he would try to get food. And then people started coming down. And this is such a strange reality. We're hungry. And one woman came down. She spoke to me first in French and then in English. And she was explaining she was very hungry, a woman maybe in her 60s. And so we gave her some food. Then she started speaking to the soldier in Hebrew. She said in Hebrew, I heard it very clearly, I am Jewish. I am Jewish from Iraq. And she holds up her ID that proves that she is Jewish. She must be married to a Palestinian. The soldier turns to the other soldiers and says in Hebrew, this woman is Jewish. And they are dumbfounded that this Jewish woman could be living in Bethlehem, because that's a place with terrorists, and that she's living in safety. And we pass out the rest of the food, and then the trip was completed when we went to Christmas Lutheran Church. Mitri Rahek, the pastor, was very ill. It was thought that maybe he had pneumonia. And we went upstairs, and all their trash was on the stairway going up to their family apartment, because they, of course, couldn't. There was nowhere to take it. And we went in. We were really well received, and had a, you know, were able to give food to them. They, of course, said, even though we knew they didn't have much food, said we can't take it. And so finally we said, well, you know people that need it then. Please, you deliver it to them. You give it to them. And they agreed to do that.
Who was it that couldn't take it?
The pastor and his family.
He felt he couldn't take it because...
Yeah, there were others that needed it.
Yeah, the author of this book.
Yes. Yeah. So I encourage, that book is in the bookstore. A book by Fred, Bethlehem 2000, which lifts up the hope of Bethlehem, the history of Bethlehem over the last 2,000 plus years.
I'm going to tell one other story.
Okay.
I had seen glass in my mind because at a little bit later time, I was able to go in with a small delegation from the New England Synod while they were still under siege, and took some of the broken glass from the Christmas church with me when I left. Because Mitri, when we were there together, had given each of us a stained glass ornament that had been made in the center there with exactly the message of, we have to make something out of all of this broken glass. We can't just succumb to this kind of destruction, but the Christian witness needs to be the making of something.
And so you think, as an international, you're coming, this is what I want to why one of the reasons I urge you to think about coming, it is very important to come. You think as an international you're bringing comfort and solidarity and prayers, but it's the wonderful thing that happens in Emmaus where everything is reversed and you receive, in this case, receiving a message of hope from a Palestinian. And that happens continuously, and that's why it's such a blessing.
Who was sick and under siege.
Yeah. You know, you become the one that receives the blessing.
So
thank you for coming. If you haven't received a cross from Bethlehem, please take it.